Tonight, we're going to talk about the diagnosis, the control, and the management of Yoni's disease, and particularly in sheep. And I was talking to our speakers before the call. When I grew up on the farm, every single skinny ewe that showed up, whether she was ill or ill thrift or just not doing that well, was classified as Yoni's. But I think as collectively we've fed our sheep better, put on more weight and so on, we've come to realise the actual cause or the actual signs of the disease and the actual causes of it, and it needs to be taken a wee bit more seriously than just a catch-all for any ewe that's not doing too well. I'm actually going to hand over reasonably soon to Kayleen Larkin, who's the consortium manager, who's been looking after the Yoni's Disease Research Consortium, or the JDRC, as I'll refer to it for the rest of the call. The JDRC, I think, has been going for about 8 years, and Kayleen, this is just swan song tomorrow, I think, is it? The end
correct,
of your baby's about to leave home.
That's right, yeah. So we've been running for 8 years, 2008, and tomorrow, well, actually on the 30th of June, we came to a close. So we've had an eight-year research portfolio covering off things like diagnostics, epidemiology, pathobiology, and genes and markers. And our role was to use science to develop cost-effective tools for farmers to reduce the impact of Yoni's on farm. And a lot of our early work was actually finding out how much Yoni's is actually affecting. So like you said, Aaron, a lot of farmers looked at their sheep and we actually looked dying from Yoni's, but we wanted to put some real figures and numbers around it. So we got some prevalence data for New Zealand that was the first of its kind that really that we had. And as an output, at the end of it all, we've come up with some information to help farmers better manage Yoni's. We know that it's a fairly low-level threat for most farmers, but for those that are badly affected, it does eat into their profits, and we wanted to give them tools to be able to manage. So in our time, we've developed some fact sheets that, for beef and sheep, which Beef and Lamb has published for us, and we've also got a toolbox just recently been published out through Dairy NZ to help farmers manage. There's a lot of science underpinning all of that information, but it's best practice management there. It's probably just also worth acknowledging that our funders were Beef and Lamb New Zealand, Dairy NZ and Dairy Industry New Zealand, and we've had researchers from Livestock Improvement Corporation, Ag Research, Massey University and Otago University working away for us, and I wrote out a list of how many of those were yesterday. It's kind of like over 30, 40 researchers that have had put time and effort into this for us. And all accumulates tomorrow. We've got a big workshop here in Wellington and getting some speakers in to talk about what we've found and just to acknowledge the research team and the work that they've put in for us over that time. So.
Thanks, Kayleen. Now, look, the JDRC is quite notable. There's a number of these running, but this is one that's actually done its job and is packing up and going home, whereas the others, like a lot of science, always have something else they just need to research for a wee while longer.
So. There's probably more that could be done, but yeah,
it's our job. So Kayleen has to head off. Her board are in town tonight, and she wants to catch up. But we just pulled her in at the start to a bit of background for the JDRC, but there's one particular question we wanted her to provide some feedback on. We normally wait for the questions a wee bit later, but this one involves Yoni's vaccination and TB. And as our speaker's from Australia, he's pointed out rather pointedly, I think, that they don't have to deal with TB anymore. But I responded that most of our TB is due to an Australian visitor anyway. Awesome. So we'll get to that later. But the question, Kayleen, I'll summarise, it's quite long, is around the Goudia vaccine that apparently works very effectively. But there's we're talking mainly about sheep tonight, but there's some concerns, I understand, from our TB-free people that it may interact or interfere with our TB testing regime. Can I talk about the situation and where we're at?
So I can describe that for you. So Goudia is freely available for use in sheep in New Zealand, and in fact, our fact sheets recommend that if you're seeing overt signs of and deaths from Yoni's on your farm, that actually vaccination is probably one of the best tools that you have. So in terms of the TB question, that comes down to cattle. And the vaccine that would normally be used is Silrim. Sorry, I don't say that one very easily. It's too many L's and R's in that word. So it's not registered for use in New Zealand, but can be used under permit. And in those cases, it does interfere with TB testing, and there is a comparative test that can be used to rule out whether it's Yoni's or not. So in special circumstances, it can be used. and that's up to the individual farmer to make that decision with their vet. It's worth noting that vaccination doesn't stop the disease, it just reduces the numbers of mortalities usually and the amount of shedding. And we've just actually recently done a review because there's a number of reasons, including the TB issue, why we don't use vaccination in cattle in New Zealand, and have come to the conclusion that there might be cause in high prevalence farms to actually take up vaccination. It could be useful for farmers, but the situation has not changed yet, and we're just feeding that information back to industry and having a discussion about whether we should be looking at moving that. But if you're having issues with yonis and cattle, our first step would be to use the recommendations in the toolbox,
mm-hmm.
in the dairy toolbox. And if that's not getting on top of things for you, then have a discussion with your vet about vaccination. But it would be an exceptional circumstance that would get you to use that.
So just the second part of this question, is there a comparative test? You know what I'm...
Yeah, there's a test that rules out whether it's reaction to the TB or...
Do we have that in New Zealand at the moment?
It's accessible, yeah.
But not readily available.
And it comes at a cost. So if you're going to do it, you're going to have to pay the cost that's associated with that, and I don't have those figures in my available. So.
All right, thanks. Okay, so we'll move on to the rest of the call. But Kayleen's going to head off now, eh?
Yeah,
thanks, Kayleen. So our main guest tonight, well, I shouldn't say that, Kayleen's had a very important role in the JDRC, as you've heard, but our guest tonight's in New Zealand to speak to producers and researchers at the JDRC workshop on Yoni's disease, which, as Kayleen said, marks the end of the JDRC. So Richard Whittington is a professor in the Faculty of Veterinary Science at the University of Sydney, and he was recommended to us on the call as a holder of a wealth of knowledge around diagnostics and sheep and control programs for Yoni's disease. Tonight he's going to cover off a few key points of management disease, and we'll go through a question and answer session. But before we get to that, I welcome you to the call, Richard. Maybe can we start with a wee bit of a potted history of yourself, how you got to be here, your background, your work, and I understand you know a bit about oysters too.
Huh. Well, that might be too long a story for a call like this, but I'm a veterinarian. I've been involved in chronic intractable problems in the livestock sector for around 30 years, specialising in bacterial infections. And you're quite right, we also work in fisheries and aquaculture with problems that are plaguing industries and seem to have no solutions at times. And Yoni's is certainly a really difficult problem. It's an international issue, and there are people all over the world who are coming to grips with the drivers for this disease and how to try and slow it down. So it's not something that New Zealand has to deal with alone, fortunately, or Australia for that matter. It's something that is the subject of great discussion and will be for some time to come, I'm sure.
Good. So look, we'll hook into the questions and answers, and you may have the odd point you want to throw up as well as we go through, but the key one that's come up several times, and I'll summarise this one, is how important is nutrition to Yoni's disease? If we graze higher covers, run our stock at higher body condition scores, are we going to reduce the severity of the disease?
Well, not necessarily. I think most of the infection with Yoni's begins early in life, and that's a matter of contamination. So contamination of the environment, the degree of contamination and the degree of exposure of young animals, be they sheep or cattle. Once that infection is established, a number of things can happen. Some animals will hold on to that infection for their entire life. Some animals will throw the infection off and have a complete recovery, and we've got good evidence for that, while others will maintain the infection for a while, and then the infection will get the upper hand and they'll break down with clinical Yoni's disease. Factors like nutrition and general stresses of livestock husbandry, including things like calving or lambing in older animals, and even transport stress can precipitate Yoni's disease in individual animals, clinical Yoni's disease, where they lose weight and eventually die. But nutrition per se is not recognised as something that will be beneficial and prevent Yoni's disease. It may be that if nutrition's particularly poor, that the impact of Yoni's disease will be seen earlier. In other words, a crash in body condition. One thing about nutrition that I think is important is that under some grazing systems, for example, strip or cell grazing, where very large numbers of stock are kept on very small lush areas for periods of time and then moved on to another area. The fecal contamination from the infected animals in the mob becomes concentrated on a small area and accessible to other animals. And under those conditions in Australia, we've seen mortality rates in adult sheep of up to 25% per annum. And we are, for that reason, recommending against practices like cell grazing.
So on the nutrition then, but in sheep in particular, are there breed differences and susceptibility, impact of the disease?
There's often a feeling that merinos are more susceptible than other breeds. And there's some truth in that. We've done a controlled experiment, in fact, that finished last year, where we had 36 sheep in a number of breeds, including Border Leicester, Suffolk Cross, and what else did we have? There was another one, it's just slipped my mind. The bottom line was that they were all pretty much the same. The same proportion of sheep got infected. Representatives in each breed developed severe disease. They shed large quantities of the Yonis bacteria in their feces. But there was one important difference, and that was that the merinos got sick first. And they were easier to diagnose as well. And in fact, some of the blood tests worked poorly in other breeds of sheep for unknown reasons at this stage. So I think the take-home message is it really doesn't matter what breed of sheep you have. They are, in fact, all susceptible.
So maybe just, I think we've got a few people on tonight who have from a veterinary background know a bit more about it, but for those of us that aren't, can you just talk a bit more about what actually is causing the disease? And I know there's a wee bit of, it's an important point that farmers typically see a wasting sheep or open it up, it's got the damage to the gut and so on, so maybe talk about those, but the actual paratuberculosis that causes it is
well, it's
quite
a,
widespread.
It's a bacterial infection, and it's a bacterial pathogen that has a very, very tough, waxy cell wall that is completely resistant to desiccation and also to many chemical disinfectants. And it's also quite resistant to being broken down in the body by cells called macrophages, which are scavenger cells that will pick up foreign material inside an animal's body and destroy it. Well, they're not capable of destroying these mycobacteria. And it's very similar in TB, same problem. So these infections are acquired by ingestion mostly, and the bacteria pass through the wall of the small intestine and then lodge in the tissues deep within the wall of the gut. And they can sit there for the entire life of the animal, the animal's unable to get rid of them in many cases. And once they start to proliferate switch the immune system from an active state into something that's not very effective, then the bacterium has the upper hand and the pathology of the disease begins. And that's really an accumulation of scavenger cells called macrophages in the lining of the gut, which causes great thickening. And as you can imagine, then the digestive processes are inefficient and the animals eventually lose weight and die.
So is it solely that direct impact of affecting their nutrition, their ability to digest food, or is there some other?
There's some other factors as well. In fact, the organism activates part of the immune system that causes the animal to go into a real negative state where its body condition falls away. So faster than you would expect through starvation alone. And in some ways it resembles a neoplasm or a cancer, a virulent infection that resembles a malignant type of cancer.
You talked a wee bit about the start about nutrition. I mean, some animals can happily carry that paratuberculosis through their life, has no impact. Do we know, how well do we understand what triggers that?
We don't know that very well at all, although we have a lot of research around that question at the moment. Our research program has been particularly interested in the switch that occurs in some animals that enables them to recover. We don't know yet whether that's a genetic switch or something that's influenced by the environment, but there is definitely a point during the infection where some animals go on and make a complete recovery. We're also very interested in the group that rather than just maintains a steady state, that become the basket cases of Yoni's disease and develop weight loss and die. So we're looking for the switches that occur in the immune system and also at the genetic level.
So one question we're going to get to in a wee bit more depth later, but we were having a discussion about it beforehand, is the speed at which that pathology, or whatever the right word is, can actually happen. It's quite possible to have views that may be excellent to very, very good body condition, but you'll see the thickening of the gut and all those sorts of lesions and things you were talking about. It can move that fast.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the pattern of disease that's visible to the naked eye is very interesting, and most people will tell you that in an infected flock, the animals that get sick and die go downhill very quickly, and that's a very common observation. Now, we've taken that a little bit further and actually weighed animals every month of their life out to adulthood, and discovered a very interesting feature, and that is that the weight loss that's due to Yoni's disease infection actually begins very early. But unless you've got a control group and you're doing accurate comparisons, you don't pick that up. So there are very significant subclinical production losses in sheep 18 months to 2 years before animals become sick and die. And that was quite surprising.
And at that time, they'll be shedding large amounts of bacteria.
It begins before the weight loss, actually, or the failure to gain weight at a rate equivalent to uninfected sheep. That effect begins before they shed bacteria in their feces. So it's a metabolic problem, and it starts quite early, and it's economically very significant. So we're talking about kilogram differences over a period of 12 or 18 months in body weight.
Okay, so we'll get a wee bit more onto some of what it all means, but I just want to expand a wee bit more. Kayleen talked a wee bit about vaccination type issues. I think one of the things she touched on there is that vaccination is a control or management, not a cure. Do you want to talk about what vaccine actually does, how it can help, when you might make the decision to vaccinate?
Absolutely. A great tool in sheep for preventing most of the mortalities and for reducing the amount of contamination of the environment. And it's now really the mainstay for control of avian Yoni's disease in Australia. So the Goulian vaccine, which is made in Spain and imported under licence into Australia, is used widely. I think in excess of 30 million doses have been administered since the vaccine was registered. We've got a population of about 70 million sheep at the moment. The vaccine is given only to lambs, so the lamb drop of the year, and it therefore takes around 5 years for the whole flock to have been vaccinated. So you vaccinate lambs each year and they accumulate in the flock. Only one dose of this vaccine is needed, and the effect of the vaccine is quite profound. It prevents 90% of the mortalities that would otherwise occur due to Yoni's disease, and it reduces the contamination of the environment by about 90% as well. And those two things mean that there's an economic benefit. You're no longer losing sheep, so that loss through deaths is removed. And you're going to get a benefit of reduced infection rates in the next generation of lambs. So that's the good news. The bad news is that a small proportion of sheep will actually shed huge numbers of bacteria despite vaccination. And we now know that the persistence of Yoni's disease in a flock, and indeed in cattle as well, is due to a small percentage of the animals that are basket cases. And we call those animals super shedders. And they have deficient immune responses, vast numbers of bacteria build up in the wall of the gut, inside the scavenger cells, the macrophages, and they're shed into the feces and they pass out every day. And we are talking about hundreds of millions of bacteria in every gram of feces. And over a day, a sheep can produce 1.2 kilos of feces. So we're talking vast numbers of bacteria. So those few sheep that don't respond adequately to vaccination are responsible for maintaining the infection in that flock. We just completed a study where we followed 12 flocks of merino sheep for 12 years. And we measured the bacterial shedding rates in those flocks over that period. And at the end of the 12 years, we still had 8 flocks in the trial. 4 had left the trial because the farms were sold and for other reasons, but we had 8 flocks left after 12 years. In 3 of those 8 flocks, we could still find sheep that were shedding Yoni's disease bacteria, despite vaccination of lambs every single year. Now, what that means is that once you start vaccinating, you need to make some decisions. You need to balance the cost of the vaccine with the economic benefit. If you decide to stop vaccinating because you're no longer suffering losses of sheep, you will eventually experience those losses in that flock again and you'll have to recommence vaccination. Some producers in Australia don't want to see another dead sheep with Yoni's disease and they're going to vaccinate regardless. There are others who have a much more finely tuned business model and they will turn their vaccine on and off according to their perception of the mortalities. And they'll only be vaccinating certain groups of sheep as well, depending on the age structure of the flock. They may not vaccinate sheep that are only going to be kept for a few years. They may not vaccinate wethers, for example. So there's a lot of variations on the theme. But it is a good control mechanism. There's one other disadvantage of use of Goudier vaccine, and that is it is extremely dangerous for humans who self-inject. Self-injection of this vaccine means a trip to the doctor and often a trip to a surgeon to have the vaccine injection site opened up surgically and that vaccine cleaned out. If you don't do that, it sets up a nasty, long-term, severe inflammatory process in the muscle or the tissue where it was injected, and that can lead to multiple bouts of surgery. And for that reason, research is underway in Australia to try and take the sting out of Goudier vaccine to make it a much safer product, and it looks like that research will be successful, and hopefully over time we'll see Goudier just toned down a little bit and it becoming a routine product where it'll be unfortunate if you inject yourself, but it won't be such serious consequences.
Is it the vaccine itself that does that, or the oil-based product that's in?
It's a combination of all of the ingredients in the vaccine contributing to it and causing a good immune response, but also a pretty severe inflammatory response.
What's the what is the sort of the economic decider? How do you decide whether Goudier is going to be worth it? So, I mean, we're assuming paratuberculosis, the bacteria is pretty much widespread in the sheep flock in New Zealand and Australia. It's pretty much, we assume it's everywhere.
No, it's not everywhere. The Australian situation is that we've got very large proportions of the industry that don't have Yoni's disease. We've got large regions where Yoni's disease is not present or extremely rare and vaccines not used. The other side of the coin is we've got some areas where Yoni's disease is very common, where at least 40% of flocks are infected, and that would probably be the case in parts of New Zealand. So the decision to vaccinate really depends on the extent of the losses that you're experiencing if you're looking at it purely from economic perspectives. There is an argument for using vaccine to prevent infection, to try to increase the immunity in a flock to reduce the likelihood that it will become infected. We don't actually have a lot of data on the effectiveness of that approach. In fact, I'm not aware of studies where the impact of vaccine as a preventative measure has been studied.
The states in Australia, I think, have some movement control, right?
There are movement controls under various state jurisdictions, and these are subject to change. There's been recently a review of the effectiveness of those and also the cost and benefits of those control mechanisms. So I think it's a sea of change at the moment in Australia, and the attitudes to Yoni's disease are in great flux. There's been a review of the bovine Yoni's disease program, and that's really washed through the industry at large.
So is that would be quite difficult to enforce, movement control and sheep?
Movement controls can be difficult to enforce across state. What can be difficult to manage across state boundaries because of differences in prevalence between the various states. So Queensland, for example, has almost no Yoni's disease in sheep. Victoria has much higher levels than, say, southern New South Wales, southeastern New South Wales. So it's not a popular thing to contemplate moving infected sheep from a high prevalence area to a low prevalence area.
We're actually going to talk a wee bit about diagnosis. That's probably a good time and to use the movement. How do people know they've got it, or how do they know if they haven't got it?
Well, knowing whether you do or don't have Yoni's disease is a matter of accumulating evidence. So history, for a start, if you have Yoni's in your district, if you have Yoni's amongst your neighbours, then you're at risk of having Yoni's. If you've purchased sheep or cattle from other properties, then you've got a risk of having Yoni's, because bringing in animals onto your farm is really the most efficient way of bringing this disease into your own livestock. There are tests available. Those tests have quite severe limitations. They are improving, and there are strategies that will give you a fairly good level of confidence that you do or don't have Lyme's disease. And that's a matter of testing groups of animals rather than individual animals using the most sensitive tests available.
So you talk about movement of stock. I mean, is it even as simple as bringing on sires? Rams or bulls are potentially...
It only takes one. It only takes one animal that's shedding significant numbers of bacteria for a reasonable period of time to contaminate an environment where young animals are grazing, and for the infection then to establish in homebred stock. That build-up of infection to the point where it would be noticeable can take more than 10 years. And usually the diagnosis of Yoni's disease on a farm that has had no mortalities of any kind caused by Yoni's in the past, that first diagnosis is often a surprise. Mm-hmm. We've seen so many examples of this in Australia, in places where Yoni's has not occurred before, where it pops up and people are scratching their heads and wondering, how did this happen? Well, it happened, but it happened a long time ago. It's just taken years to reveal itself. And the reason for this is that young animals are susceptible to the infection, but it's the dose that makes the difference. So a low dose of bacteria, as you might get if only one infected animal has been brought onto a property and it's been spread around in the environment, a low dose might take 5 years or 10 years or even 15 years to cause disease. And that's beyond the economic life of most animals. They're gone before they get sick. However, if those animals start to shed the bacteria onto the pasture, and as more of them do that, then the infectious dose on the pasture builds up. And the next lot of young animals that come by are exposed to a higher dose. And that means that they will develop the infection faster and have a greater chance of developing the clinical form of the disease within their economic lifespan. And that's when you start to notice Yoni's disease. But that process can take 10 years.
So the number one animal health issue in New Zealand is internal parasites. New Zealand has they maintain themselves on the pasture. The majority of our internal parasites are on the pasture. How long does Yoni's or the bacteria persist on pasture? Does it survive frost, sunlight?
Well, it's a pretty tough organism, as I said before. It's like it's like a piece of cheese in a wax rind. So you can leave it out in dry conditions and it stays nice inside, alive. The thing that it doesn't like is changes in temperature. Big daily fluctuations in temperature seem to upset it more than drying out. So we've got a rule of thumb under Australian pasture conditions. So we're talking about temperate pasture in southeastern Australia. 90% of the bacteria die each month after they've been deposited on pasture. Now that sounds like a really nice kind of happy outcome, 90% dead after a month. The only problem is we're coming off a very high base. So if you've got a million organisms in a gram of feces, and a sheep pellet's 5 grams usually, so you've got a million organisms sitting there in a teaspoon, after 1 month, you've still got 100,000 live bacteria there. And after a second month, you've got 10,000 live bacteria. So even though 90% die each month, it takes many, many months for all of them to die. And the rule of thumb we use for complete safety is 2 complete summers of pasture spelling to rid that paddock, if you like, or that farm of environmental contamination.
and that's it's the same organism between cattle and sheep, so it's not just about one class or one species.
You could use the same figures for both sheep and cattle strains, and I think you'd be pretty safe.
A lot of internal parasites, you spell a paddock from sheep grazing, graze with cattle, you're fine, but this won't work in this case. Exactly the same.
Well, in that context, you do have some options. So if you wanted to use pasture that has been contaminated, you could graze animals that have been turned off for slaughter, for example. So that could be sheep grazing on sheep pasture, but the sheep you're using to vacuum up the bacteria, for example, you're going to send away before they've had time to develop the disease. So that's one strategy. Another is to graze adult cattle, which would be quite resistant to infection with ovine strains, certainly. It gets a little bit tricky, though, if you've also got calves at foot. It wouldn't be a great idea because we've got many examples now of calves grazing on heavily infected pasture next to infected sheep, and those calves become infected.
So just want to circle back. You talked about the super shedders. So vaccine is a tool, but there's persistent super shedders. What's causing that? Is it environmental, genetic, or do we know?
That's a great question. It's likely to have a genetic component because some animals are inherently more resistant than others, and we've in fact identified some of the genes that are potentially responsible for that resistance or susceptibility. But there may well be other factors involved, including the dose of organisms that the animal was first exposed to as a lamb or a calf, and other environmental effects that are not understood at all.
So what's the options? I know certainly in New Zealand, I think in Australia as well, we've made some fairly significant strides with breeding for tolerance or resistance to internal parasites, same with facial eczema, which we have there in the upper half of New Zealand. What are the opportunities, or are there any opportunities for breeding to improve tolerance or resistance?
I can't really answer that question authoritatively. From an Australian perspective, we have identified groups of genes that are associated with resistance and susceptibility in both sheep and cattle. We're not sure yet how well distributed those genes are in the population of livestock at large, and we're not sure about the heritability. However, there are some good examples from New Zealand in deer for both Yoni's disease and TB. And there may well be some exciting research findings in the Yoni's consortium that will be revealed tomorrow.
All right. Well, we actually had Kayleen dropped off a copy of their R&D record, so I haven't had a look through it yet, so I don't know whether that's in there, but we will be following up after the meeting tomorrow. Just looking at time, the primary driver for a lot of this work in New Zealand, and I suspect in Australia, has been on-farm productivity type issues and productivity and profitability. There's another issue around yonis that there's perhaps no definitive answers in, but the issue of it is a human health risk or a food safety type issue. And we had some questions come in about animals going to the works. We've touched on the fact that we can have animals that look perfectly healthy that are carrying paratuberculosis. Don't want to put too much on your shoulders, but what can you say about that issue, about the issue of risk to humans and how we can manage that as well?
That's getting into a very complex area, but it's one that we must not run away from, and particularly the veterinary profession needs to take notice of issues like this because of their complexity and the fact that it involves animals and farming systems and also the potential for an interaction with human health. There have been many studies around the world that have shown that Mycobacterium paratuberculosis can infect a wide range of species other than sheep and cattle, and species including humans. So this organism has been isolated from humans with disease, intestinal disease of various kinds, Crohn's disease and some other bowel conditions. It's also been isolated from people who are called controls. So these are people who don't have Crohn's disease. Because of that complexity, public health authorities around the world have been unable to say with any confidence whether or not Mycobacterium paratuberculosis causes disease in humans. So this is a very subtle distinction. It is definitely statistically associated with certain bowel diseases in humans, but whether it causes those diseases is completely unclear. So we have a situation where public health authorities are very happy with the principles of disease control that have been adopted by animal health authorities around the world to try and reduce the level of Yoni's disease in flocks of sheep, herds of cattle, and in other species in order to reduce the presence of this organism in the human food chain. So that's the situation internationally in terms of official public health statements. So it's not stated to be a cause of human disease, but it is associated with certain conditions in people, but no cause and effect. Several countries have adopted an eradication program. Norway is one of those. They have a policy of stamping out Yoni's disease in any ruminant species where it's detected. The Japanese have also adopted a very stringent policy of removing this organism from the human food chain. They've recently banned the importation of live Australian cattle because of the detection of para-TB in imported animals. And there's an investigation underway as we speak in Australia as to how that could have happened. It's been taken very seriously by the Australian authorities because the Japanese are a favoured and very valuable trading partner for Australia. So what can be done? Well, the kinds of control recommendations that are being promoted in New Zealand and Australia are really consistent with programs from many other countries, many other developed countries. They're as good as they get for the moment, and there will be improvements over time as research improves, diagnostic tests and vaccines improve. And I think the message for the general public is that the livestock industries take this very seriously. They take a very responsible position. They're very concerned about product quality, about the image, and the overall package that is being presented to consumers, and that is a great industry and a great product. The veterinary profession needs to watch this very carefully. It needs to provide good, objective advice to farmers. We need to avoid extremist views, and sometimes these are promoted by often people with vested interests, including researchers with vested interests who'd love to see more research on topics like this. We have to watch, we have to filter that information, and we have to take notice, I think, of major international reviews conducted by reputable agencies like Health Canada, who've just published two studies on this particular topic, and they're available in the scientific literature and they're well worth reading.
Just on that, I mean, the transfer to humans is via food. Is there a direct risk? You know, farmers are dealing with dirty animals and dirty stuff every day.
One of the issues that is causing the health authorities to kind of stand back is the fact that exposure to this organism, occupational exposure to this organism, farming, for example, vets who do postmortems on sick animals, people working in meatworks and so on, there is no increased incidence of Crohn's disease or any of these other diseases in these people. And so this occupational exposure is not followed by a greater risk of developing these diseases. And that's tending to point to a whole range of other factors that must be present in certain susceptible individuals before any disease occurs. And those factors are not well understood. However, there are some genetic predispositions to Crohn's disease, not necessarily to infection with paratuberculosis in humans, but to Crohn's disease, which is a gut syndrome. Definitely there are genetic predispositions. And that may have greater impact, in fact, than mere exposure to this organism.
You tap with meat, cooking will, you talk about how tough the bacteria is, but cooking properly will kill it, destroy it.
Absolutely.
And when we talk cooking properly, what are we talking?
Well, we're not talking about incineration. We're talking about cooking meat to the point where it's well done, so where it's brown. We've done very objective, in fact, meticulous studies funded by the red meat industry in Australia to show that cooking red meat will in fact completely destroy para-TB. So the Sunday roast is fine. And it's a great thing, cooking. It actually improves the flavour, I think, too.
Indeed. All right. Hey, look, I'm just keeping an eye on time. We've got a few minutes left. So what I might just bring a chance to sort of perhaps wrap up a wee bit. We've got a number of farmers listening, and we've got people who advise farmers and work with farmers. If you're a sheep farmer, and I presume it's not a huge difference between Australia and New Zealand, what would be the things you're doing to, you know, sort out what's the level of Yoni's disease in your flock, what's out there, what would you be advising a farmer to go out and start looking at, measuring, recording?
I think good farmers are already doing all these things. Recording routine cases of ill thrift, for example, making sure that the tail of a mob, animals that are poor doers, are investigated by a veterinarian to find out why. And of course, there are many factors involved, from mineral deficiencies, internal parasitism, broken mouth ewes, for example, lots of causes of body weight fall off. But have it investigated so you know what's going on if you're a flock with an unknown Yoni's disease status at the moment. If you find that you are infected, get professional advice. This is not something that is easy to work through on your own. You need to work out whether it's having an economic effect, how your business might be affected. Is it going to be cost effective to vaccinate? Are you at the point where you need to? So there are a number of considerations where it's very helpful to have some independent, objective advice.
Very good. All right, thanks, Richard. Look, we're going to wrap up there. Richard's possibly heading out for tea. Sounds like he's having a steak. Well done. But we will wrap up there. As I said, we've got the recording of the call, which we will make available real shortly. But I just want to say the last couple of words. Thank you all that out there that have dialed in, sent in your questions, that have been listening. The recording's on the Beef and Lamb New Zealand podcast channel, which you can find if you go to beefandlambnz.com. It's on the front page, but we'll send out an email of that as well, and a link to some of the materials we've referenced tonight, and possibly some more stuff that we're going to hear about tomorrow from the JDRC wrap-up. But finally, look, a thank you to Kayleen, who's not here, who came in away from her dinner just to say a couple of words. And a very large thank you to our guest tonight, Richard Whittington, who took time out of what's a relatively short flying visit over here. And I was going to say he missed his dinner, but he'll still may be able to make it by the sounds of it to join us on the call tonight. So all the best tomorrow for the workshop, Richard. Thank you all out there, and good night.